Well, as it happens, I'm a Capricorn, so Saturn is one of my people. But we also know that Saturn gets a very bad press. You know, Scorpios get bad press, and people forget the positive Saturn. And Blake described that when he said, either make up your own system or be enslaved by another person. So Saturn is connected with systems. Saturn is connected with not thinking singly, not having an insight here and insight there. So, as you know, the Renaissance speculators, like the people of the Kabbalah, brought in systems into Europe. And Blake's system was developed from the huge systems that were available to him at the time. And we in the New Age hate systems, which means you're a sucker for someone like Reagan. So Saturn, the positive side of Saturn, is that you think long way ahead and that you imagine vast interlocking groups of ideas. And I don't believe in any one group. As I said last night, I think the Jungians are codifying too much. They sound like Marxists when they start to talk. They just repeat the words over and over. The problem isn't that Jung has a great system. It's that you need about 10 of them to understand the complexity of the universe. The Catholics have a wonderful system. The astrologers have a wonderful system. The Jungians have a wonderful system. The Marxists have a very good system. It explains a lot. And the Republicans don't have any, but... So, I also am a Gurdjieffian. I believe tremendously in the system that Gurdjieff brought forward, and that's related to the Sufi system. Sufis have a fantastic system, and as you know, the Buddhists have theirs, which is very powerful. So what I'm saying is that you don't choose between having a system and having none, that the universe is so incredibly spherical that you need 9 or 10 of these to get even a grasp on what's at the center. Does that make any sense to you? So one of the systems that Blake says is think in the morning, do in the afternoon, eat in the evening, sleep at night. So that's why you're here right now. And as Janet mentioned, I know that Marion Woodman insisted on this last year, that the thinking be in the morning. And then they sent me her schedule, so I assumed it would be the same this year. I don't know what we should do about tomorrow night. Tomorrow, we have tomorrow scheduled 10 to 12 interest groups and 3 to 5 interest groups and then 8 to 10 the session in the evening. Morning is the best time. Evening is all right, too. It's a little festive. In the afternoon, nothing. So therefore, would you think a little bit of what you'd like to do tomorrow? Several people have to leave in the afternoon, in the afternoon today, and won't be back until tomorrow evening, but I don't know if we should consider them or not. How do you feel right now? Would you rather have a thinking session tomorrow morning, or shall we leave it where it is tomorrow night? Here we go. America is always 2 points. Everyone who thinks it should be in the morning tomorrow, please stand up. All right. Now look at each other. You see, those are all morning people. Wow. Hey. All of those who believe that it should be in the evening tomorrow, please stand up. Mm-hmm. I like these looking people too. But it looks like you're outvoted. Shall we do it this way? How does that feel to you? All right, so I'm glad to have your feeling about it. If you have your little schedule with you, I'll tell you what I plan to do. In my case. Today we're going to deal primarily with the story of Iron John, or the Wild Man. We're going to try to do that today, this morning. Tomorrow, whatever time the session is, I want to deal with something new that I've been working on, which is naivete in men. The curious quality of naivete and passivity. somewhere in this area. So that'll be my subject for the next one. And it's something I've just begun to think about. Tomorrow in the first interest group, let's go back here. There'll be an interest group this afternoon at 3 to 5, and I'll be with the large men's group for that one. Then at 8 to 10, I'll be glad to visit any of the other interest groups if you would like to ask me, if you have some questions about what's coming today. So all you have to do is tell me if you wish. Some of them would be glad I'm not there. And others might want to. So I'll be available tonight from 8 to 10 for any of the interest groups that would like me to visit there. Then tomorrow we have an interest group. We have two interest groups. And the first one, whether that takes place at 10 or at 3, we'll decide that, I guess, later. I would like to invite all the men to come to that one from whatever group they're in. And I would like to give a special talk to them on shame. Something I became aware of only about 2 years ago. We talk about affects. We talk about affects, such as among the affects are emotions that affect the body. And surprise is an affect. Fear is an affect. Joy is an affect. And I found out that I was a shame person. I'm not a joy person nor a surprise person, a shame person. So I would like to talk about, I understand that women have tremendous shame, and so many times I put on the painting by Rembrandt that shows Susanna when she was peered on by the elder. That's the greatest painting of female shame that I've ever seen. But it's also true of the soul of the man. So what I would like to do then, I'm grateful that we have a men's group here. And I myself have taught women's groups. I taught women's groups first, and then I taught women's and men's. And lately I realized what women have realized for a long time, that men say different things when there are no women present. Just as women say certain things when there are no men present. So please don't feel excluded. Please don't get hurt feelings on this issue. Because there are certain things that the women have found out that they're willing to share with each other, that they're hesitating to share when men are present. And we have found the same thing. One thing you can say is that each sex is more square in the presence of the other. Men become quite zany when they're with each other. And they will say things that they hesitate to say in the front of a woman because so much shame came to us from our teachers, our grade school teachers, who were mostly women. If we wish to change the relationship of women and men in this country, the first thing we need to do is to get a lot of male teachers in kindergarten, second, third, and fourth grade. And I'm very much a believer in what Helen Dinerstein said, that if we wish to change the relationships of men and women in this country, that the men are not angry at women in power, in the power situation, politics, and so on. She said she thought that when she started her book, The Mermaid and the Minotaur. The more she went into it, she spent 17 years in the Brandeis Library working on that book, and the more she came to it, the more she realized the problem between men and women is that women have too much power when the child is 1 and 2 years old. And if the mother wishes to change you, she does. And if she doesn't wish to change you, you don't. And we feel that, and the girls feel it very much. So therefore, we have an experience of too much power on us when we're very small. This is not the fault of the mother. Nobody is doing anything wrong. You understand me what I'm saying? You can't always run and change this little brat every time they want to be changed. But we feel it. We feel it. It's power. We want something. You won't give it to us. We want the breath. You won't give it to us. So therefore, she said, we won't change this by law. It's an anger that men have against women, because at one time the women had much more power. There's an anger that women have against women, because at one time that large woman had more power. So Helen Bernstein says, if you wish to change that, then the thing to do is that the men have to begin taking part at the age of 2 and 3 months with the children so the anger can be spread around evenly. That's quite right. You'll never get rid of the anger because no one is doing anything wrong. So the thing is to spread it. Well, I like that. I like that very much. Now, does anyone have hurt feelings about this issue of my inviting the men from whatever group to come in for that session to listen to the talk on shame? Are you all? Yes, please. Now, I'm going to meet the group leaders at lunch. I haven't met them before. And I'm perfectly willing to cancel the whole thing if they feel they don't wish to do that. One advantage... Yes, please. Yeah. Yeah. I got you. I've done that group work, and it's infuriating for someone else. But I thought of one advantage, which was that it'll allow the women to have some time together to talk over some of the stuff that's coming up this week, and that's an advantage. Other ways, a disadvantage, yes. Yep, I do too. She says she thinks the small group process is just as important as these, and I agree with her. And she says if the men are not there for that session, it will affect that session. Which is quite true. Yes. I don't know. He's got a problem, that one. Yeah. She says, is there a possibility of you having another time with the men? Why not? What's the matter with that? Can we do it? Where is the... See, we're talking over long enough. There's a solution. Does that feel all right for you? Would the women like to have a time? Yes. All right. So thank you. That's nice we went through that. And I'm willing to do that. Do you think we can find a time for that? Good. Let's do it. Because I want to give as much as I can because I may never see you again. You know, I'm working on a book, and I may stop teaching completely. I may die. Who knows? So I might as well tell you everything I know, you know. Yes. Yes, please. Tell everybody that, would you?
The 1 o'clock time this afternoon is an open time. We may be tired. This evening after the small interest groups is another time.
What time is that?
That is at 10. We may also be exhausted.
Yeah, 10 wouldn't be a good time. I don't think the late evening is a good time. One on a rainy day is good. All right, I'll invite the men then back to that place over there at Steinbeck at 1 o'clock this afternoon. We won't get a nap, but what the hell. I was looking forward to a nap. Yes, please. Okay, thank you. All right, we've got a lot of things to do this morning, so I'd like to forge ahead unless someone would bring one. Thank you for bringing up all those things so we could go through this. Anyone else? Yes, please. Yes, the question was something like, would you talk a little bit about the idea of a man approaching his father around 45? And is there a similar process for a woman? And I don't know about that. I know that the time sequence is different for men and women with a whole lot of things. They're a little faster than we are. They get there a little earlier. So maybe around 35 would be a time for women. But I feel that this approaching of the father, again, the most important thing I think I said last night is that if you wish it to be done, you must do it yourself. You must take the initiative. The initiative has to come. You cannot wait, because the males in our culture don't make that kind of a movement in the first place. And the fathers are afraid of their daughters, number two, and they're also ashamed of the fact that they haven't had a close relationship with them and they feel guilty. And somehow all that has to be taken in. And then you have to go, and don't let them bluff you out. Does anyone have any advice for her on this question of approaching, or a woman approaching her father? I wanted to just add one thing that came up today when we were talking. A woman spoke to me, and she said, you know, I went to my father when he was dying, and I wanted that thing that I hadn't received. And I said to her, you know, she said, I said to him, you know, I love you. And he said, right. You know, just before he died, he said something like, drive carefully, you know. What can you do? I mean, there's two things to be said. First of all, it isn't over yet. You can often have a better relationship with your father after he's dead than before. People learn something by dying. And the conversation does not end. Conversation does not end. So please have confidence in that too, that many things can be said. But before the father dies, you always have to recognize the fact that you're not going to get it. Even if you go, you're not going to get it. He's not going to give it to you. I have to accept that with my father. He's not going to do it. And you live with that. It's like once you get it clearly and you don't have this incessant longing, then it's better. Am I saying anything to you? And I think the main thing also when you go is not to have hurt feelings at all of the negative stuff that will come towards you. You just have to give up the hurt feelings completely. If you get one moment of true feeling out of an hour and a half of that stuff, that's as much as you can expect, maybe. Yes? Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book by Linda Leonard. It's a book called The Wounded Woman. I know her, and in the beginning it was called The Wounded Daughter of the Wounded Father, and a stupid publisher wouldn't allow her to call it that. It's called The Wounded Woman, which is all right, but it's a wonderful book. Linda Leonard. And her wound was that she was with her father up at the age of five, and she was very warm with him and all of that. Then he became an alcoholic, and wham, he pushed her away. And her father image was entirely smashed. So she talks, what do you do when the image of your father is completely smashed? What does the woman do then? Yes. Thank you. If you go to your father three or four times and you don't get anything, you still have done that. There's some reason that it didn't go through, and it's not for you to blame your father or yourself with it either. At least you went through that. Yes, please. Yes. I don't want to go into it at great length except to say that if you are able, you know, I'll just mention something, that Marie-Louise von Franz is a very smart woman. She's in the second generation of the Jungians. And I was with her in Notre Dame one time, and she talked about the little figure that women have on their left shoulder. It's a small man, about 5 inches tall, who talks to her and says, you know something, you're nothing. You're absolutely worthless.
You'll never do any work of art because you're a woman. That's why, because you're nothing.
She says, every woman has that little figure on her left shoulder now. So people said, well, what can you do about that? Can you kill him? And she said, no. You cannot kill this little figure. The only thing you can do is educate him. And so people said, is that figure still with you, Miss Van Frans? She said, yes. And she was in the motel at Notre Dame, and I knew she'd been working on a book that morning. She said, yes. This morning I worked on my book, and he said to me, this is going to be no good. Your work is never any good. She said, I turned to him and I said, but you know, my last book got very good reviews in the United States. And he said, what do they know about it? With wonderful European arrogance. And she said, but my last book got a very good review in Basel. He said, I bet it was a Jungian that reviewed it. And she said, no, as a matter of fact, it was a Freudian. You see, these people don't read reviews. And so she said, no, as a matter of fact, it was a Freudian, and he gave me a good review. And then he said, So she said, I won that one, and he left me alone for up to 2 hours. So I brought this up as an elaborate introduction to this statement to you, because her point is that what we need to do is not to try to kill these figures, but to get in conversation with them. She said, what happens to women and why they get so crushed by this interior critic is that he will imitate your mother or your father's voice. And you will assume it's your voice, too. And as soon as you address him and make him talk, it's clear it's not you. Is that clear? As soon as you get in the conversation, it's clear there are two entities here discussing something with each other. And that's the great moment in which you begin to be free. That's her advice. That's called educating him to take conversation. And men also, we have a little figure on our left shoulder. It's a little woman about 4 inches tall. You know what she says? You're cute. This little woman does not criticize us. We don't have that thing that you have as much. We got another one of our high school superintendent is over here saying that. But on this side, we got this little figure saying, you're very cute. You know, you're very cute. Your wife doesn't understand you. Can you see the trouble this might lead to? Ask Gary Hart about it. The problem is he isn't even cute because she lies all the time. So, all right. That was just a joke there. But this, we lose our lives in these little jokes with us people on our left shoulder. Hmm? So I just wanted that as a preface to saying to you that when your father is dead at 12, he isn't gone. And you can have conversations with him. I was in Minneapolis. I gave a first talk on men 2 or 3 years ago. It was a group like this, maybe a little larger. And in the question period, there was a boy, a man at the back, that said, Robert, we were talking about initiation of men. Of other men. He said, do you think that our fathers can do some initiation after they're dead? I said, you know, I had enough brains that night to say, what do you think? He said, well, I'll tell you a strange story. You see, my father died 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. My brother and I recently, 6 months ago, were in his bedroom. My brother and I were there, and I felt his presence there. My brother did too. He didn't like it, but I liked it. And then all of a sudden, something strange happened. I saw two men with black cloaks on them pass through the room. Now, they were the same men in Sicily where my father was from. That's the black cloak that the shepherds wear. And I felt a moment of initiation come through me as those two figures went through the room. So the implication was that the father had gone to some of the old men, grandfathers or whatever, from Sicily, and said, would you go and initiate my two boys? Whew. That's strong material. But that's why I have confidence in you. Don't believe that that relationship is over. It isn't over yet. Shall we go? Anyone want to say anything to me before we go on? Yes, please. I will put it up here. Is this better? Please speak up if you can't hear me. Can everyone hear me? All right now, if it doesn't slide. I have written a poem about that, which will remind me. I will read you. I'm just finishing it now. It's called Shame in the Voice. I don't want to be distracted right now. Thank you, though. I love her enthusiasm. Read it. I want to go on and do two poems. Then I want to give you the beginning of the story of the wild man. And then I want to continue with a couple of slides on the wild man, and we'll finish the story. So that's what we're going to do. Our first section will be a few poems, two poems, and then we'll do the story, and we'll talk about that. And the story, and particularly, this is an old story of initiation of men from Northern Europe, and I'm addressing it particularly to the men. So I would like the questions to come primarily from them. I have been with men and women many times, in which I've enjoyed it very much. But as you know, the women are more verbal. They ask the questions first. And the men sit and don't say anything. Well, she's asking, so I don't ask them. So wait a little until some of the introverted men ask a question. Is this fair for you? Yeah. Now, what I want to do first then is to do a poem from my own childhood, which I didn't finish until last year, because I'm a child of an alcoholic father. And as you know, the denial system is very strong. I began this poem when I was 28 or 30. I did the first stanza, and I could see it was turning into something serious, so I stopped the poem. I didn't find it until 25 years later when I was doing my selected poems and I looked over my notes. So here's the poem. It talks about snow geese in Minnesota, Canadian snow geese, that come down like this. In the fall, they land in the cornfields where the pickers have been and have knocked a few ears off. And they'll eat that corn and then go south. I've known this scene since I was a boy. So I'll give you that poem. The dark geese treading blowing Dakota snows, over the fence stairs of the small farms come, slipping through cries flung up into the night, and settling between them, shifting wings light down at last in bare and snowy fields. That's the first stanza. I'll give it again. The dark geese treading blowing Dakota snows, over the fence stairs of the small farms come, slipping through cries flung up into the night, and settling between them, shifting wings, light down at last in bare and snowy fields. The drunken father has pulled the boy inside. The boy breaks free, turns, leaves the house. He spends that night out eating with the geese, where alert and balancing on wide feet, crossing rows, they walk through the broken stalks. I'll do the last stanza for you again. Don't mean that the father pulls the boy inside the house. He pulls him inside himself. Is that clear? The drunken father has pulled the boy inside. The boy breaks free, turns, leaves the house. How many women have said to me when my parents are arguing, I'd walk on the railroad track for 3 miles. The drunken father has pulled the boy inside. He breaks free, turns, leaves the house.
He spends that night out eating with the geese. We're alert and balancing on wide feet, crossing roads, they walk through the broken stalks. And you feel the isolation there? But that isolation is one of the first wounds we get, men and women. In my case, I have to look at it and I have to say, I'm not going to go into self-pity on this. Because if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't have gotten in contact with the geese. My first book was called Silence in the Snowy Field. In fact, the image came from the last line of the first stanza, which I'd never even known at the time I wrote the book. If that hadn't happened, I might have been caught inside the house. That's terrible too, isn't it? Yeah. But all families, in a way, have alcoholic parents. I always thought it was only mine. I thought our family was the one. Now I'm still looking for one that isn't. So I'm talking of this from the point of view of the male now. What I said just now was true of the male and the woman and the man. But I want to read you a poem now which goes into more of the way it feels as the male gets older. And I mentioned last night that I had a conspiracy with my mother to push my father out. And you know these conspiracies all over families. Oftentimes a daughter will have a conspiracy with her father to push her mother out. There's a lot of these conspiracies. And my mother, of course, was what they call codependent. She said exactly the right thing to keep my father drinking all the time. That's the way those things go. So here's the poem. I have done for a long time an exercise which was implied by what I said about News of the Universe, which is instead of writing at my desk, I go out and when I see something out there, I look at it and write it and try to put it in language. It's looking at what's out there. And I took a long walk in Minnesota in a lake to the north. And I came back and I walked down to the lake and it was dusk. And there were some hills in the south and west part of the lake. And it was just dusk and they had thrown a shadow over about half of the lake. Then this half of the lake was in light. Then there was a row of reeds and a little bit of really brilliant water next to the shore, between the shore and the reeds. Do you see that scene? So I did a description of it. It's not a poem, you're just doing it. I just did a description of it. And when I finished it and looked at it, it turns out that all the images for the dark part of the lake were male, and all the images for the light part were female. And of course that's the opposite of what Jung says. Jung always associates a female in the dark and the male in the light. So I said, wow, this is interesting. We're contradicting Jung, it must be interesting. So I went to the work of typing it up. And then after you type it up, then there's two or three years of working on it. And I spent 3 or 4 years getting this thing into shape. But I was interested because I trust my perceptions more than Jung's. And that's, we have to learn to do that. So I'll read you the first stanza describes the dark part of the lake, and these are the images that came. After a long walk in the woods, clear cut for lumber, lit up by a few young pines, I turn home, drawn to water. A coffin-like band softens half the lake. Coal draws the shadow down from westward hill. It is a massive, masculine shadow. 50 males sitting together in hall or crowded room, lifting something indistinct up into the resonating night. I'll give you the sense again. After a long walk in the woods, clear cut for lumber,
lit up by a few young pines, I turn home, drawn to water. A coffin-like band softens half the lake, draws the shadow down from westward hill. It is a massive, masculine shadow. 50 males sitting together in hall or crowded room, lifting something indistinct up into the resonating night. Second stanza. Sunlight kindles the water still free of shadow, kindles it till it glows with the faint pink of wounds. Reeds stand about in groups unevenly, as if they might finally ascend to the sky altogether. Reeds protect the band near shore. Each reed has its own thin thread of darkness inside. So it is relaxed and rooted in the black mud and snail shells under the sand. That's how women feel to me sometimes. Each reed has a thin thread of darkness inside. So it is relaxed and rooted in the black mud and snail shells under the sand. Third stanza. The woman stays in the kitchen and does not want to waste fuel by lighting a lamp as she waits for the drunk husband to come home. Then she serves him food in silence. What does the sun do? He turns away, loses courage, goes outdoors to feed with wild things, lives among dens and huts, eats distance and silence. He grows long wings, enters the spiral, ascends. I'll give you that stanza again. I'm making a connection there between the young male who is forced out by this material and those young males that fly to Oregon with Rajneesh. This is called the flying boy when they come into spirituality too early. There's nothing wrong with that, but you understand they fly sometimes to India. I was that type. Shall I give you the stanza again? The woman sits by the stove and does not want to waste fuel as she waits for the drunk husband to come home. Then she serves him food in silence. What does the son do? He loses courage, turns away, lives among dens, goes outdoors to feed with wild things. There's the geese again. Goes outdoors to feed with wild things, lives among dens and huts. Eats distance and silence. He grows long wings, enters the spiral, ascends. How far he is from working men when he is 40, from all men. Did you hear that? How far he is from working men when he is 40, from all men. The male singing chant far out in the water, grounded in downward shadow. He cannot go there because he has not grieved as humans grieve. See, what's approaching now is my sense that in my family somebody's head was cut off. He cannot go there because he has not grieved as humans grieve. If someone's head was cut off, whose was it? The father's or the mother's or his? I'm saying before a male can become a human being, he has to grieve over those heads that are cut off in our families. Is that clear? And I don't know the answer even right now. I said to my wife, you think it's my father's? She nodded, and I said, you think it's my mother? She knew my mother. She nodded. She said, how about yours? The dark comes down slowly, the way snow falls or herds pass a cave mouth. I look up at the other shore. It is night. So sometimes I'll say to a group, there's a certain moment in your life in which you try to look at your parents for what they really are. Not to blame them, just to look at what they are. That moment is called night. All the lies I told all the way through college and beyond. That's the denial system of the alcoholic family. What kind of a child did you have, Robert? Wonderful. A lot of sheep and horses. Great. I learned to lie. That was the first lies I told. And once you learn to lie about things like your childhood, you can lie about anything. You know, Reagan had an alcoholic father. And he has not done that kind of work of grieving. You know, and if you can lie about your childhood being happy with an alcoholic father, then you can even say that if we raise the military budget and cut taxes, we can balance the budget. You can say anything. How far he is from working men when he is 40. From all men. The males chanting, have you ever heard Tibetan men chanting? The males chanting, the males singing chant far out in the water, grounded in downward shadow. He cannot go there because he has not grieved as humans grieve. It took me 45 years to begin to grieve. If someone's head was cut off, whose was it? The father? Or the mother? Or mine? The dark comes down slowly, the way snow falls or herds pass a cave mouth. I look up at the other shore. It is night. All right. Does that give you a feeling of what it's like for the young male in that situation? How can we possibly have a close relationship with women? How can we talk to you in the way that you quite rightly ask us to do? When we cannot grieve, when we're isolated out among beasts, when we can't be with other men because we don't feel worthy of it somehow. What if there are no groups of men to be with? Anyone want to say anything to me now before we go on? Yes, please.